What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. European Union leaders agree on a plan to send thousands of migrants to Turkey. In exchange, Turkey would get certain political concessions and financial aid. The EU would pay Turkey to take back migrants who do not qualify for asylum in Greece. Tens of thousands of other refugees would be spread out evenly across the EU. Henry Ridgewell has more.
The EU's refugee relocation scheme is aimed at Syrians. The fate of other nationalities is as yet undecided. Part of Europe's proposed deal with Ankara would see migrants here in Greece sent back to Turkey. Under normal European rules, those subject to persecution are able to claim asylum in the EU. But the European rulebook is being rewritten, and the future for the refugees stranded in Greece is highly uncertain. Henry Ridgewell, Athens.
Sudan is threatening to close its border with neighboring South Sudan. It says South Sudan is supporting rebels fighting the Sudanese government. A senior assistant to President Omar al-Bashir Thursday aired the accusation and border warning. The foreign minister of South Sudan denies the charge. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says atrocities committed by the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria amount to genocide.
But over the past months, we have conducted a review of the vast amount of information gathered by the State Department, by our intelligence community, by outside groups. And my conclusion is based on that information and on the nature of the acts reported.
Kerry says the group targets Yazidis, Christians, Shiites, and other populations for abuse. The genocide declaration means the U.S. could prosecute any Islamic State member in the U.S. This is VOA News. The Islamic State group lost 22% of its territory in the past 15 months. The monitoring group Jane's says the losses are due to increased military pressure against the group, both in Syria and Iraq. Jane says the IS is increasingly isolated. Syrian Kurds declared a federal region Thursday in areas they control in the northern part of the country. It is a move that was immediately rejected by both the Syrian government and the main opposition group, the Syrian National Coalition. Saudi Arabia says it is ending its major combat operations in Yemen. That announcement comes a year after a Saudi coalition launched airstrikes against Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen. Following this week's primary elections in the U.S., Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump are strongly in the lead toward gaining their party's presidential nominations. That makes it more likely that Clinton and Trump will be opponents in the general election in November. Party nominations won't be confirmed until the national conventions in July. North Korea has fired another ballistic missile just days after the United States imposed new sanctions on the North. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said the missile flew 800 kilometers before crashing into the sea Friday. Top U.S. defense officials say Russia's military intervention in Syria failed to achieve its stated goals and likely lowered Russia's standing in the region. Defense Secretary Ash Carter told members of the Senate Armed Services Committee Thursday that Russia prolonged the Syrian civil war and failed to focus its fight on the Islamic State group.
Russia said it was coming into Syria to fight ISIL, but that's not what it did. Instead, their military has only prolonged the civil war, propped up Assad, and as of now, we haven't seen whether Russia retained the leverage to find a diplomatic way forward.
Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a partial withdrawal of Russian forces Monday, but said Thursday Russia could ramp up its military presence in Syria within several hours if necessary. Morocco has ordered 84 United Nations peacekeepers out of the Western Sahara. It took the move after UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called the Moroccan presence in the territory an occupation. Morocco considers the area a part of its territory and accuses Mr. Ban of failing to be neutral on the matter. The governor of the U.S. state of Michigan and the country's top environmental official took blame Thursday for the toxic water crisis in Flint, Michigan. The tainted water has left many children in that town with high levels of lead in their bloodstreams. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder told a contentious congressional hearing in Washington that the crisis represents a failure of government on all levels, local, state, and federal. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, March 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan denies it is supporting rebels fighting against the Khartoum government.
President Salva and the government are fully committed to see that there is peace in Sudan and peace in South Sudan. And the president is very clear that we will not support any armed insurgents against the Republic of Sudan.
Banama Meral Benjamin is South Sudan's foreign minister. Sierra Leone has once again been declared Ebola-free. Nigeria's military denies undermining free speech following the seizure of five newspapers. And Liberia and Ivory Coast call for regional approach to fighting terrorism.
Both President Ouattara and President Johnson Sirleaf agreed that ECOWAS as a regional body must play a very key and pivotal role in putting security at the top of the agenda.
Eugene Nabe is Liberia's Minister of Information. Meanwhile, Ghana on Thursday declared a terror alert. And we'll tell you about Malawi's homemade helicopter. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudanese authorities in Khartoum on Thursday once again accused South Sudan of supporting rebels fighting the government of President Omar al-Bashir. Ibrahim Mahamud-Hamid, a senior assistant to President Bashir, says Sudan will close its borders with South Sudan and deport more than 300,000 South Sudanese who are studying in various parts of the country in response to Juba's alleged decision to support Sudanese rebels. But as we hear in this report by John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program, the South Sudan government has denied the allegations.
Rabi Abdelati is a senior member of Sudan's ruling National Congress Party. He says Juba's support to the rebels fighting the government of Sudan is creating instability between the two countries.
This really affects the security and affects peace and affects the southern government. As we know that now the situation in southern Sudan is miserable and it is not a situation of stability. And I think that this stance of certain government to cooperate with ESL and North, this will definitely result in negative impact on the two countries.
Abdelati says the Kiir administration should instead focus on ending the two-year conflict that is threatening to tear South Sudan in what he calls ethnic enclaves. South Sudan's foreign minister, Barnaba Marial, denies his government is supporting rebels of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, or SPLA-North, who are fighting government forces in southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states. To the contrary, Marial says South Sudan is working to bring peace in southern Kordofan and Blue Nile.
President Salva and the government are fully committed to see that there is peace in Sudan and peace in South Sudan. And the president is very clear that we will not support any armed insurgents against the Republic of Sudan.
Marial says his government can end the conflict in Sudan's restive southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states if given a chance to do so.
Some of these problems can actually be resolved by enhancing our trade, encouraging the movement of the people, educating our children together. I think these are some of the ways, the guaranteed ways, in which I think Sudan and South Sudan can always live peacefully side by side.
Abdelati disagrees. He says the government of South Sudan has never been honest and insists that Juba is still supporting Sudanese rebels.
Whenever, these borders is open and to be exploited by the SPLM North and to launch hostilities against Southern Kordofan or Brunei, this will definitely actually disturb the agreement, and also there is no use of opening borders.
Sudan and South Sudan signed a cooperation agreement 4 years ago to stop supporting rebels in each other's country, promote trade, and create two viable states. Earlier this year, President Omar al-Bashir issued orders to open Sudan's border in order to help Juba cope up with its deepening economic crisis. Marial says his country has historic ties to Sudan. He says Juba is working to convince the SPLA North to end the fighting in southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states.
We have that relationship, whether it is a social relationship, whether we were in one country before. This can be used for the advantage of South Sudan, putting pressure on our brothers and sisters in the Sudan so that they can reach a peaceful agreement that will make our region a viable region politically, economically, and even socially and culturally. And that's what we are for in the Republic of South Sudan.
This is not the first time the two countries have accused each other of supporting rebels fighting in each other's countries. South Sudan's foreign minister expressed concerns last year about reports that Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir promised military support to rebel leader Riek Machar to forcefully take power in the world's newest nation.
That was John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reporting. Liberia and Ivory Coast have called for increased coordinated regional approach to deal with the terrorism threat in West Africa. Both Presidents Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia and Alassane Ouattara of Ivory Coast made a call on Thursday at the end of bilateral security talks in Ivory Coast capital Abidjan. Their meeting came on the heels of Sunday's terror attack in Grand Bassam, Ivory Coast. Liberia's Information Minister Eugene Naboe says the two leaders agreed to put security at the top on the agenda of the next meeting of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS.
Already there are several measures that have been increased, including internal surveillance, increase in intelligence gathering, intelligence sharing, cross-border cooperation. All of these things are happening. But both President Ouattara and President Johnson Sirleaf agreed that this must be expanded and that ECOWAS as a regional body must play a very key and pivotal role in putting security at the top of the agenda. And the both leaders also pledged that at the next meeting of the Economic Community of West African States, security will be a priority so that we can discuss this in a regional context and also to encourage the international community to focus more on security, not just in West Africa, but on the continent as a whole. President Sirleaf also sounded a clarion call that once you involve the people, involve the community in security, we can have an enhanced framework that will eventually defeat terrorism.
And this is coming on the same day that Ghana declared a terror alert. Is there a concern now in the West African community following the attack in Cote d'Ivoire and previously Mali that perhaps countries like Liberia and now Ghana are next?
Definitely, there is general concern throughout West Africa and even beyond West Africa in the Maghreb and other areas in Africa about the growing threat of terrorism and the increasing number of extremist attacks. So Liberia, like other countries, we have already put into place measures, increased our security apparatus to prevent and avert such an attack. President Sirleaf has been on the phone the whole while, interacting with other leaders in the region, including the Mana River Union region and the ECOWAS region. So all of these activities are being done in concert so that West Africa can have a comprehensive security plan to avert any terrorist attacks.
Mr. Minister, the World Happiness Report was released on Wednesday, and Liberia is one of the countries mentioned in that, that people in that country and other countries around the world are not happy. Have you seen that report and anything you want to say about the fact that Liberia is mentioned about their people not being happy?
Well, listen, since President Sirleaf took over this country in 2006, after all, we have had years of very devastating civil conflict. She has worked very tediously to put into place measures and programs and projects and activities to alleviate the dire state that our country was in when she took over. So, yes, I think in a way the president is a victim of her own success. These reports are good because they gave us a chance to look at ourselves and see where we have challenges, mend some of these challenges that we have, and make progress. So we are not happy that we are being branded as unhappy people, but we will continue to persevere with the development agenda. And as we work harder for the people of Liberia, we think some of these reports will change.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's Information Minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, March 18th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The Ghanaian government on Thursday put the nation on high alert in the wake of Sunday's deadly terror attack in neighboring Ivory Coast. Francesca Kakra-Forson reports for VOA from Accra.
Ghana's national security chiefs say they have intelligence of a credible terrorist threat in the country. They made the announcement on Wednesday following a meeting with Ghana's President John Mahama, to review their readiness. In a statement, the government called on Ghanaians to pay attention and report anything unusual to security agencies. The terror alert is a first for the West African country. Since November, Al-Qaeda militants have attacked hotels in two other regional capitals, Bamako and Ouagadougou, and a beach resort outside Abidjan. Despite the government assurances, many here wonder, is Ghana next? And how prepared are we?
We have a very porous set of borders, and it's not properly policed. Mm-hmm. There are lots of unapproved rules. I think that we should have been proactive. But this is the disconnect I worry about.
No, this is not the first time. It's serious, but it's not worrying me. Probably it's not worrying me till it happens.
We should look at our movements. If you have nothing to do in certain areas, don't go there. If you're a terrorist and you hear Ghanaians are really aware, they are preparing, you know, to combat anybody who comes into their land, then obviously you also want to hold back.
The United Kingdom has advised its citizens in Ghana to be cautious. And on Wednesday, the U.S. military restricted travel by its service members to Ghana and four other West African countries. Francisca Forsen for VOA News, Accra.
Nigeria's military has seized five newspapers accused of publishing what the military calls seditious materials that could undermine the country's unity as well as impact negatively on the ongoing fight against Boko Haram. The seizures are reportedly generating anti-government sentiment in the country's Igbo-speaking southeast. Military spokesman Colonel Sani Kukasheka Usma says the seized publications had called for secession of the region from Nigeria. In this interview with reporter Peter Clarty, Usma denied the seizures will stir more anti-government sentiments.
Contrary to some media reports that there was seizure of such nature, actually they were not newspapers per se, but some seditious publication capable of causing disaffection among the components of Nigerian society.
Specifically, what seditious material are we talking about? Are we talking about publication that will inflame anti-government sentiment or cause disaffection or disunity among the people of Nigeria?
It is the latter two, disaffection and provocative publication. It is not necessarily anti-government. The publications, you cannot even rate them as newspaper because all the Nigerian newspapers are well-known in the country. They were seditious publications, a kind of inciting people against the other components of the Nigerian society. And, of course, you need, when you are prosecuting people, you need evidence to prosecute them with. So basically, that was what happened.
So with these newspapers blamed for undermining the social cohesion of Nigeria, be prosecuted within the Nigerian military laws or regular civilian court?
It is not Nigerian military. Nigerian military always try military personnel when they err in the eyes of the law. You can understand that the country is facing quite a number of security challenges, and we are trying hard to foster unity and cohesion among the component groups. So you cannot afford to have some people, you know, doing otherwise. There are legitimate and more civilized way of, you know, pressing demands and creating disaffection among the society.
These are concerns expressed by some of the publishers of the publication seized. They said no amount of effort by the military to gag the press will work, adding that the military were overstepping their bounds. What is your reaction to such
concerns? Naturally, Peter, people always talk the way they would like to, but what I want them to do is to understand the context and the circumstances under which certain things are done. So you don't come out and make sweeping statements or generalizations like that without taking into cognizance certain basic facts or realities of the time. Naturally, nobody can cut the press. And you should know that the Nigerian press is one of the most vibrant, free and independent. We have quite a number of publications, radio stations and television. And that is what makes the society better and democracy flourish.
Colonel Sani Kukasheka Osma is Nigeria's military spokesman. He was speaking with reporter Peter Clotty from Abuja. Sierra Leoneans had a low-key celebration on Thursday after their country was once again declared Ebola-free by the World Health Organization after completing 42 days without any new confirmed Ebola infections. Sierra Leone was first declared Ebola-free on November 7th last year, but since then, there have been two cases or flare-ups of the virus. Newly appointed presidential spokesman Abdoulaye Birete says President Ernest Bai Koroma has told Sierra Leoneans not to be complacent, but to continue to be vigilant because the virus could strike again.
So far, the mood was a little bit low-key here, except that the president had to talk about it, that indeed we are very thankful that when this outbreak came out in Maboraka, at least the government was able to activate the measures it has put in place based on the lessons we have learned in the past when we had the first outbreak in 2014. So that is why he also reminded the public that in as much as we are also being declared Ebola-free today, after having got through the 42-day cycle, we should always make sure, based on the predictions made by WHO, that there is a possibility of any future outbreak, just in case, that we must continue to observe the IPCs, that is the infection prevention controls in all our hospitals. And as I'm speaking to you now, we are at an advanced stage whereby we continue to train all our frontline health workers so that they can always be ready in case of any eventuality.
And I think the World Health Organization has issued a skepticism or warning that this is not the time for Sierra Leone to rest on its laurels.
Absolutely. And that is why, even though it is low-key, for the president, he takes it very seriously that even during last Tuesday, when he was addressing the International Women's Day in a very mammoth gathering, the president took the opportunity to dilate first on Ebola, that in as much as the government and our development partners, we know what to do in the case of any eventuality. We must double our efforts without taking chances. That way, if any surprise comes, at least we should activate all our surveillance and contact tracers as we did in the second outbreak, because we now know what to do as a government. But at the same time, the communities must be very vigilant.
Mr. Birete, it's always nice to talk with you on Daybreak Africa. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Newly presidential spokesman Abdoulaye Birete was speaking with me from the Sierra Leone capital, Freetown. A former radio repairman in Malawi has built a helicopter out of scrap material. Civil aviation officials have grounded him for now, but he says he's not giving up. Lamek Masina reports from his workshop in Doa, central Malawi.
Felix Kambwiri has dreamed of flying since he was a little boy. He says he used to be fascinated with the helicopters. His state president would fly during crop inspection tours. He says the helicopters would sometimes land on his school grounds, and that this is when he decided that one day he would make his own. Now, at the age of 45, the professional welder and a father of seven has done it. The engine roars as he turns the machine on in his garage. It shakes as if eager to lift off. Orange indicator lights flash from the cockpit and the tail. Onlookers step by to avoid the rotating blades. The helicopter is white with a blue and red stripe down the side, all of it built from the scrap metal he gathered locally. It took him 4 months to build. The cockpit is big enough to fit one adult. He uses a 125 cubic centimeter engine he dismounted from his old motorbike.
About 30 kilometers.
Kambwiri says he plans to use the helicopter to avoid bad loads when he visits his home village about 30 kilometers away. But police blocked his first attempt at a test flight. Civil aviation authorities say they need to run a safety checks once Kambwiri installs a more powerful engine. He's saving up the $800 needed to buy one. He says, even if my first test flight fails, I will not relent until I make this helicopter fly. He says some more educated people have told him he cannot possibly succeed. But his small aircraft has won the hearts and minds of locals who stop by to admire it, like this local teacher.
My impression, maybe this one, if they have money to become bigger and want to fly with this.
Kambwili joins a small but persistent group of amateur aircraft builders in Africa. A Nigeria physics student managed to get his helicopter built in 2007, 7 feet off the ground. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Doha, Malawi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Nigeria has been drawn in Group B for the 2016 FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup. According to the draws held in Zurich, Switzerland on Thursday, Nigeria, who were runners-up at this tournament 2 years ago, faced Canada, Japan and seeded side Spain in their preliminary round fixtures. Ghana is in Group C with New Zealand, the United States of America and seeded side France. Germany is the defending champion at the three-week tournament starting in Port Moresby in the capital of Papua New Guinea on the 13th of November. Staying with women's football, hosts Namibia play Zambia in the return leg of the Africa Women's Cup of Nations qualifiers in Windhoek today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Morocco host Mali in Sale. Mauritius are at home to Botswana in Curepipe. Tunisia face visitors Burkina Faso in Ouad Elil. And Guinea welcome Senegal to Conakry. On Sunday, Egypt host Libya in Alexandria as Tanzania travel to Harare to face Zimbabwe. In Namibia, the Namibian boys under 17 team host defending champions Ghana, South Africa and Westphalia from Germany in a tournament starting in Walvis Bay, some 400 kilometers west of the Namibian capital Windhoek, tomorrow Saturday. This tournament in the Namibian main port city runs until the 24th of March. Turning to hockey, Nigeria play Botswana in the opening match at the Africa Junior Hockey Championships starting in Windhoek, Namibia today, Friday. In the other men matches, Zimbabwe engage Tanzania and Egypt encounter Namibia. In the women's contest, Tanzania plays Zimbabwe and Namibia face Botswana. Tomorrow, Saturday, features women's matches only, where South Africa meet Botswana and Namibia play Zimbabwe. The men return to action on Sunday with Nigeria playing Tanzania, Egypt tackles Botswana and South Africa engages Namibia. The tournament is a qualifier for the World Under-21 Men's and Women's Championships in India and Chile, respectively. Finally, in athletics, Kenya's world women's 10,000-meter champion Vivian Cheruiyot makes her debut at the 21.1-kilometer distance when she competes in the Lisbon Half Marathon in the Portuguese capital Lisbon on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning. And that's it for this Friday, March 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We will discuss the Benin presidential election. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
Stand up! Stand up!
Starting Monday, your favorite sports show is expanding to half an hour a day, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT, right here on VOA Africa.
We will rock you!
Tune in. You'll be glad you did.